This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
It's the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and today we are joined by Professor Andre van Niekerk, and the prof is a pulmonologist, pediatric, and past chairman of the Allergy Association of South Africa and founding member of the Allergy and Clinical Immunology, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Foundation of South Africa. Let us have your questions for the prof on our studio WhatsApp number 0618951019. And we'll get back to the professor now after these words from our sponsors.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Thank you for tuning in to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 Chai FM. It's Monday and my name is Nicholas Ingle. I'm chatting with Professor Andre van Niekerk. We're going to be chatting all things asthma in adults and in children. Prof, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Nicholas. I appreciate it.
Really do appreciate you making the time. No, it's a very you're busy and it's a busy time of year. So let's kick it off. Firstly, I think just before we started recording, we were chatting about asthma, and one of the biggest challenges is potentially the misdiagnosis of asthma and the working with your work with immunology. There we go. Let me butcher a few more words. Prof, you wouldn't think that I also do announcing at sports events internationally. So when we're getting sort of the Mongolian names and the Eastern names, how badly I butcher those names. So I'm doing my best here. But give us a rundown, a brief intro into what is asthma.
So, Nicholas, I think what's important is we need to understand that asthma is actually an immune disease. So it is a disease where the immune system, and it's your own immune system, does not tolerate certain molecules that we are exposed to. And when we talk about asthma, it's especially molecules that we inhale into our lungs, our airways. And we must remember that allergic nose disease and asthma goes hand in hand, because the nose is part of the airway. So basically, in most patients, it's an allergic reaction or an intolerance. The immune system doesn't tolerate certain particles that we breathe, like, for example, pollen or house dust mite or particles from animals, etc.
So I suppose that's actually quite good news, because it's then treatable also through the environment, if I understand that correctly.
It is true. One can avoid these particles that we inhale and that our immune system respond to. But it's not that easy. I mean, we live in an environment full of pollen. Yes. And we can't really avoid that. Avoiding animals is easier said than done. And I think what is very important is that if we advise a patient on avoiding something, we must be absolutely sure that what we want to avoid is actually an offender, a real offender. So to give blanket advice, like remove the carpets from your house, I don't think it's sound advice if we have not confirmed that your immune system is actually responding or not tolerating the house dust mite in that carpet. So avoidance is important, but I think one must be careful that you don't turn a patient's life into misery by giving them wrong advice on avoiding. The one thing that we should always avoid is cigarette smoke. So, yes. So that's blanket. You can say that. But I think we must be cautious when we talk about avoidance.
I think that it's such an important point, because I'm sure there's a huge cost factor around that as well, that can, you know, changing your environment that could be unnecessary. I suppose the best advice, though, would maybe be to move to the coast, move to Cape Town. I'm just kidding. Just trying to get the studio down to Cape Town rather than would be a lot more fun.
The moon sort of might be a better option.
Yeah, where might be a better option? Sorry, Rob?
The moon.
The moon, okay.
Join Elon Musk to Mars or something. To Mars. But the important thing is that it's about your own immune system
yes.
that's that's causing inflammation in the airway.
Right.
And that's the important thing.
So what is the diagnosis process for asthma? What happens when the patient comes to see you?
So first of all, it comes with a typical story, a typical history. And the typical history is a history of episodes. This is important. It's not every day of your life. It's episodic. It's episodes of chest symptoms, and those symptoms are chest tightness, difficulty to breathe. But important is breathing out. It's more a matter of struggling to exhale, breathe out, than really a matter of breathing in very severe cases, breathing in. But breathing out is the problem. And that usually goes with cough. And as I said, these are episodes. And the episodes are variable. This is important. They're reversible. So whether you take medication or not, it may return back to normal. Medication will often accelerate the process of returning back to normal, but there may be spontaneous recovery. And so it's really about episodes of variable airflow limitation. And these episodes are often triggered by something, like, for example, exposure to allergens that we, or more of the allergen that we normally exposed to than normally exposed to. Or it's exposure to other triggers, like, for example, sudden cold air or after exercise, even emotions like laugh and being sad may cause these triggers or instigate these episodes. But it's really about variability. And then the other thing that's really important in the history is that it differs from patient to patient. Patients are not the same. So it's individual, it's highly individual. So it all starts the diagnosis with a history. And in children, asthma usually really, it may happen before the age of three, but the patient after the age of three that still has episodes of a wheezy chest, that's more likely asthma. And in adults as well, when they're having episodes of a wheezy or a tight chest, that's more likely asthma. But there are many mimickers to asthma. And therefore, we must really pay attention to the detail on the history that we get from the patient. So first of all, it's a history, a story. Then the second thing that's important is that we should measure and confirm that asthma is there. Now, if I've got a patient in my rooms and I listen to his chest is tight and he's wheezing, and I give him medication to open up his chest and he responds well, that's a way of measuring the clinical exam. But very often when we see the patients, they are actually normal because these are episodes and they often come to the doctor between episodes. So they're often normal in the rooms. And what we look at then, also other features that suggest allergic disease. So if it's a patient with episodes of a tight chest, but he's also got features of, for example, allergic eczema or features of allergic nose disease, that will warn you that this is more likely an asthma patient that you're dealing with. And then lastly, we come to the lab investigations, and lab investigations must be done. In all asthma. So in older patients, 6 years and older, we use a lung function machine. We call it the spirogram. That's very handy. So we need to measure what's happening in the airways with technology in the lung lab. But we've also got other ways of measuring, and that happens on blood samples or skin tests, for example. So we need to test for allergy. We need to measure the antibody that's often associated with asthma in the blood. And nowadays we've got fancy new technology where patients can just breathe into a machine and we measure the nitric oxide in the air that the patient exhales. That's a very good test that's now become available in South Africa. And then we also measure certain cells in the blood, eosinophils, that are usually associated with asthma. So a story, a clinical examination, and together with that, laboratory findings. And we prefer to have all three of these to confirm a diagnosis of asthma.
For parents with younger kids, in terms of the story, what should they be looking for? What should they be taking note of and recording in order to bring you the best possible story for a diagnosis?
So kids under five is really difficult, and we often actually have to coach the parents on what to look out for. And the problem is simple. Children, especially under the age of two, their ear pipes are small, because they are small, their pipes are small. So something like a common cold can cause really a noisy airway just because the pipes are small and not because there's asthmatic swelling, inflammation associated with asthma. So listening to a noisy chest in a young child can be very confusing. And cough is very common in young children. Children are born coughers. Their cough reflex is really strong. So even a runny nose causes a cough every night. And very often parents just report a noisy chest and cough, and then they get diagnosed with asthma. And that is not correct. So what we would really ask parents to look for is it episodic? Does it come and go? If it's a young, small child and it's every night of the life, that's not episodic. That's a different problem that you're dealing with. So is it episodic? Look out for difficult breathing. Are you just hearing a noise or are you seeing difficult breathing? So use your eyes. And if you can see that that chest is working harder during these episodes, that should alert you. And also, what's the age of the child? If this only started after the age of 3 years, it's more likely asthma. If this started at 6 months of age, it's more likely something else than asthma. So I think, there are a couple of these clues. Parents also often report a young child that's running and coughing during running. With asthma, when it's exercise inducing the asthma, the cough only often starts after the exercise, 15 minutes later. And the cough with asthma is typically a dry cough. It's not a wet, mucousy, snotty cough. And then parents are often confused about what's a wheeze. We talk about wheezing chest, but a wheezing chest is not snorting. It doesn't sound like a percolator. It sounds like a very soft whistle, a fine whistle. So there are lots to teach parents. We've got a lot to teach parents when they're observing possible asthma.
I think the observation and understanding that they are empowered in terms of what they can look out for to bring as much information to the medical professional when they bring the child in. We're going to go to an ad break now. When we come back, I want to chat to you about, and not to put, parents under more pressure or worry or concern, but what are some of the challenges if asthma is misdiagnosed? So we'll touch on that straight after these words from our sponsors.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 High FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle and I'm chatting with Professor Andre van Niekerk. We're talking asthma. Prof, before we went to ads, we chatted about the diagnosis of asthma. What are some of the challenges that a patient may face if they're misdiagnosed with being having asthma and they're not?
Well, two major challenges. The one is that you missed another diagnosis. And because you missed another diagnosis, you're missing correct treatment. The patient didn't go to the doctor because they're healthy. They went to the doctor because of a problem. And if you misdiagnose, you should have been treating another condition. And some of those conditions could be sinister. A very good example is cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis may present like asthma, and it's really an important condition to treat correctly. So misdiagnosis is the first consequence of an incorrect asthma diagnosis. And then the second biggest consequence is exposure to cortisone, because cortisone is the hallmark of asthma treatment, and it should be that way. It is the best medication we've got at the moment, but asthma treatment, cortisone should be inhaled. It should really not be something that we swallow. And therefore, the biggest problem we've got with a misdiagnosis is that patients are actually often exposed to cortisone syrups and cortisone tablets, that is really sometimes needed in true severe asthma. But in most cases of asthma, they should be, in all cases of asthma, where it's confirmed, you should be taking inhaled cortisone on a regular basis for most patients. And even if there's worsening of your asthma symptoms, flare-up of asthma symptoms, you should be taking more of the inhaled cortisone rather than systemic. In other words, tablets or syrups. So the biggest problem of misdiagnosis is the wrong diagnosis and often the overuse of orally administered, by mouth administered cortisone.
So it is really important for parents or even patients just to build that story and to bring that story to the medical professional with as much accuracy and information as possible. What I wanted to touch on and some of the triggers that may be causing asthma, I know we spoke about pollen, dust mites. What are some of the things that we should be looking out for? And also in terms of our general breathing health, our general respiratory function and sort of lung health and nose health, what should we be looking to avoid in the house or in our environment? We mentioned cigarette smoke, something that I have an absolute disdain for. I don't enjoy cigarette smoke. It really does not. The result is not good if I'm exposed to cigarette smoke. So to say that proper, what are some of the things we should be looking out for?
Well, to generalize, also indoor forms of pollution, especially. Unfortunately, many of our patients still rely on indoor fires, cooking, heating. So indoor pollution is a big problem. And more than that, there's not really much that we can do. You know, the common allergens, and I really want to emphasize, it's not the cat that's the problem. It's your immune system. That's the problem. It's you responding to the cat. So, and we really don't want to avoid house animals. Children should have pets.
Absolutely.
And only if it's the pet that's been proven to the problem should you avoid the pet. But in general, you know, nose allergy as well as lung allergy, asthma, it's really triggered by things that we breathe and that we are allergic to. And the common ones, molds, pollens, pollens, especially grass pollen, house dust mites. In the coastal regions, there's another mite called Blomia tropicalis. That's the tropical mite, is a very common problem. But we could be allergic to many things, even tree pollens. So those are things that we should try to avoid if we have to avoid them.
And then obviously find out, you know, make sure what you are allergic to, what's causing the problems before you start to remove things. And I love what you said about the pets as well. You know, it's not the pet's fault. It's your immune system really that's not able to deal with it.
And I think, Nicholas, what's really important, if we go and do allergy tests, we must remember that allergy tests may often flag something that I've got antibodies to, but my immune system is not really responding to it. And the reason is the immune system has got checks and balances, and there are regulatory cells in my immune system as well. So let's say I have no symptoms, but I go for an allergy test today. They may pick up that I'm allergic to my dog. The test may implicate that I'm allergic to my dog, but I can sleep with the dog every night and I've got no symptoms. So the test does not define allergy. It is your response that defines allergy. If I've got antibodies, IgE antibodies in my blood test to my dog, but I suffer no symptoms whatsoever, then I'm not allergic to the dog, despite the fact that the test alerts me to the possibility. So tests alert you to a possibility. You still need to confirm that there's a link between your symptoms and what you're exposed to.
Okay. That's absolutely fascinating. I think it's very, very good news as well, because if you're not having a reaction to the pet, there, even despite what your tests say, then you can still keep the pet. And I think it's something, you know, for kids to have pets, particularly dogs, big fan, you know, that's something that's so good for one's quality of life. In terms of sort of our air quality and the environment that we're living, we spoke about indoor pollution. I think air quality is getting a little bit worse. I know in Johannesburg, if you leave the city, you come back to the city, particularly in winter, you can see that brown dome over the city. How big an impact is that on sort of asthma and respiratory problems?
Well, it definitely has an impact, you know, on a population basis. I mean, there's no question that outdoor pollution is very important. What's also very interesting is that with climate change, we are seeing changes to pollen patterns. We are now having pollens in areas where we did not used to have those pollens. So air quality and aerobiology is really an important thing. The problem is that what can individuals do about it? You know, if you're going to buy a new house, try and buy away from the highway. Try not to buy the house on the highway, but I can't change the highway, you know.
Yeah.
And so on an individual basis, there's actually very little that individuals can do about this. And air quality should be more the Minister of Health's problem than it should be the individual patient's problem.
Yes, I absolutely love that. And I think the value, particularly we're very fortunate in South Africa with our climate, the value of being outside, of playing outside, of exercising outside is far more beneficial for our overall health than the air quality. In terms of exercise, if we're looking at younger kids and adolescents, how important is the participation in school sports and that for kids with asthma? And what should they be doing in terms of keeping themselves safe?
Well, exercise is extremely important. And asthma should in no way be a reason to limit exercise. You know, when asthma, if it's correctly diagnosed, and especially in children, they are highly sensitive to treatment. And the treatment is extremely effective. And if you are prescribed, if you've got the right diagnosis, you are prescribed the right treatment, and you adhere to the treatment, you take it correctly. And it's not only about collecting your prescription. It's about administering it correctly. The technique of inhaling your asthma inhaler is important. The devices that comes with it. If you do all that correctly, a child should be able to really live a normal life. There should be no limitation to any aspect of quality of life. And he should not have exacerbations. That's the goal of treatment. We should set goals for treatment. And one goal is normal exercise, is one goal of treatment. Normal sleep, normal exercise, no exacerbations, and really no need for extra medication, minimum medication.
Sure. I absolutely love that. And it is ultimately about maintaining and enhancing quality of life, not just treating the disease for the sake of treating the disease. We're going to go to ads, and when we come back, I'd like to chat about perhaps maybe let's look at my sort of experience with asthma. The last 40 years, what has the progress been, the evolution in terms of understanding asthma, respiratory disease, and the treatment? And then also I want to touch on a little bit of immunology and the developments there. So we're going to go on to that as soon as we're back from our break. You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Nicholas Engler, and I'm chatting with Professor André van Niekerk.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Thank you for staying with us here on the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm chatting with Professor André van Niekerk, and we're talking all things asthma. Prof, before we went to ads, we touched on sort of the what is happening in terms of the treatment and the understanding of asthma, the development, let's say, over the last 40 or 50 years. I'm just bringing that in because that's sort of my experience with asthma, and then also your work in immunology and how that's affecting your work with asthma.
So Nicholas, you know, we come from a history where we used to have a blue pump. a blue
Yes.
asthma inhaler. And that inhaler was my reliever inhaler. And I used it whenever my chest was tight and I had to take it before exercise. Those
Yep.
days are gone.
Okay.
It's been shown that a patient that uses more than three blue inhalers in a year is at increased risk, significant increased risk of an asthma death, or
Sure.
significant increased risk of an asthma hospitalization or even intensive care admission. So patients should not be walking around with blue pumps and taking blue pumps whenever they need them. That's not on. That comes from the era where we thought asthma was just because of muscle constriction of the airways. We now know asthma is about immunology, and asthma is about inflammation that's chronic in the airway, including the nose. That inflammation is driven by your immune responses of intolerance to certain things. And that inflammation is the cornerstone of the problem. And the type of inflammation varies from patient to patient. And therefore, we need to, first of all, use an anti-inflammatory. And the best and the safest anti-inflammatory is an inhaled cortisone that's given at the dose that's needed to control the asthma symptoms. And that cortisone should be taken at least on a daily basis in patients with more frequent asthma symptoms. With patients where the symptoms are infrequent, in other words, I've got symptoms once in 2 months or so, you still need to take that inhaled cortisone, but you take it then together with your blue pump at the time of the symptoms or the worsening of symptoms. Now, nowadays we fancy I say that the blue pump should never be used on its own. So the newer asthma inhalers combine the two in one inhaler. So you've got the cortisone that you inhale together with a bronchodilator and one single inhaler. And certain of these inhalers can be used on a daily basis and also when needed extra or only if needed. Not all of those inhalers, some of them. You
Right.
have to ask
Okay.
your doctor which one can be used that way. So, but the bottom line is that we use regular cortisone that we inhale to treat the inflammation. And if there's deterioration, additional inhaled cortisone to treat the inflammation. So that's currently the mainstay of treatment, but it works in steps that are defined by your severity. So some patients with more frequent, more severe symptoms, they need higher steps of treatment, higher doses, additional treatment. Some patients need lower steps. So we talk about step one, two, three, and four, and five. So depending on your step, and we classify your severity according to a step, we will give you a prescription that matches that step. And this is the mainstay of what we're doing at the moment. Now, unfortunately, there's a very small percentage of patients, and I must say, 90-95% of all asthma patients will be well controlled on a maintenance low medium dose of inhaled steroid together with the bronchodilator when needed. And that's really the majority of patients. But unfortunately, we've got patients who suffer severe asthma. And they are the patients who regularly need to take additional by mouth cortisone. And I already said we're worried about this. There are now studies in adults showing that as few as four short courses of cortisone in a lifetime could have long-term consequences. And
Sure.
patients who need to take by mouth cortisone twice a year, patients who took it in their life up to 10 times, let's say. It varies from patient to patient. There's a significant downstream increased risk of causing diabetes, of being associated with diabetes, for example, hypertension, early bone fractures in adults, bone density problems, stroke. I can go on and on and on.
Wow.
So any patient who needs repeated short courses of steroids by mouth, they're in trouble. And they're in long-term trouble. So for those patients, we are very excited because with immunology, and our understanding of the inflammation of what's happening in the airway, we can now target very specific molecules. The problem with cortisone that I swallow is that it really affects almost every system in my body is affected. But with new molecules that we now have, we can really target precisely, exactly, the problem behind your asthma with this molecule and avoid the exposure to all this overdoses or high doses of cortisone. They are called biologics, those medicines. And it's amazing what they're doing for patients who deserve them. They are amazing. You must just see it. And we treat patients with these new molecules, the biologics. It changes their life. It changes the quality of their life. And it avoids exposure to downstream harm with the over-reliance on oral corticosteroids.
That's absolutely unbelievable. And for our listeners, you can't see the professor smiling, but Prof, you had a big smile on your face when you were talking about this and the evolution. Where do you see this going in the future in terms of future developments for treating asthma and the understanding of the value of immunology in different diseases?
Well, Nicholas, I'm very excited because in the last 10, 15 years, new technology, and I wish we could spend hours on that, taught us the exact pathways of different forms of inflammation in the body. So immunology is now becoming the cornerstone, the anchor for the precise diagnosis and precision treatment of you name it, lists and lists of diseases, autoimmune diseases, cancers, severe allergic diseases. I can go on and on and on. So clinical immunology is becoming the future of medicine.
Right.
And I predict that in the not too distant future, we will most likely be treating patients with mild forms of asthma, with these biologics as they become available. And just to give you an idea, you've now heard a lot about this injection that we administer at home once a week for weight loss, and that's so popular, blockbuster.
Yes.
We're looking at the same stuff for asthma, and we're looking at similar stuff for asthma. And the difference is you're going to inject it once a month or once in 2 months. And it will significantly contribute to the control of your asthma. At this stage, this is really reserved for the severe asthmatics. But I really hope that it will become more freely available. And why do I hope this? Is because just like autoimmune diseases, like rheumatoid arthritis, asthma causes scarring of the airway. It's chronic inflammation. It causes injury to the airway. And if I've got a child 8 years old with uncontrolled asthma, his airway is being scarred, and it's being scarred for the rest of his life. So uncontrolled asthma at the age of 8 or 7 is a predictor for COPD when I'm an older patient. So permanent lung damage comes from this scarring. And with these new molecules, we can really target that inflammation, and we can really wipe out that inflammation and prevent scarring of that airway. And the same thing happens in the nose. Things like severe allergic rhinitis and polyps in the nose. You can't breathe with that blocked nose of yours. Sinus operations. We can now, with these precision molecules, really prevent the need for a sinus operation because of the fact that we're targeting that inflammation with precision molecules. So the future is just bright. It's there's such a lot happening. The only problem is money.
Yeah. So money in terms of, well, we're going to go to ad break now. When we come back, I'd like to chat about that and then also get your advice for our listeners on what they can be looking at to do in their day-to-day lives just to improve respiratory health and function, and maybe touch on a little bit of an exercise as well. You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 High FM, and I'm chatting with Professor André van Niekerk.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Welcome back. You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. My name's Nicholas Engel, and I'm chatting with Professor André van Niekerk, talking asthma. I was going to say this is something close to my heart, but let me just say this is something in my lungs and in my respiratory system. So, Prof, just before we went to ads, you mentioned sort of the costs. Is that sort of the costs of the research and development of the medication itself, or both?
Well, first of all, let me just clarify that 95% of asthmatic patients can be treated with medication that's really not expensive.
Okay, you're fantastic.
And they really need the correct prescription, and what is even more important, the correct device to administer medication to the lungs. You know, if it's an inhaler that contains a powder, they must know how to correctly use it. And if it's an inhaler that comes with a pump, we call it a pressurized metered-dose inhaler, it must be administered through a spacer device, even in adults. So if they take that cheap medication correctly, it will really do wonders for them. When we talk expensive, we're really talking about this 5% or maybe up to 10% of the asthma population, where they've got severe inflammation in their lungs and in the nose, usually with it, often on the skin as well. Very often severe eczema or eczema flares as well. It doesn't only happen in the lungs. It happens on the skin, eyes and nose as well. So those patients with these severe forms of inflammation, when we start treating them with biologics, it is unfortunately expensive at this stage. But like everything, I'm confident it's going to become cheaper. And it depends on your weight and your age. If you're a child and you're younger, then it's usually a bit cheaper. Mm. It's dose dependent. And if you're an adult, it is more expensive. I don't want to generalize about price, but I think we're looking at between, 10,000-20,000 rand a month at this stage. But that's one must explore your individual needs. This is just generalizing.
But I think if I understand it correctly, medicine is very much like Formula One. The developments in Formula One cars are ridiculously expensive to improve speed and handling. But as it filters down over time into our standard cars, the features we have today were 20 years ago were only available in luxury vehicles. And is that similar to with medicine, where it comes down over time?
Yeah, absolutely. It is about, we're talking high technology here, and we're talking, amazing stuff. I'm confident that understanding how these molecules work and sorting them out is more advanced than landing a helicopter on Mars.
Right.
And so we're really talking about high tech. And then comes the production of it, because we are now producing an antibody that targets one specific molecule in your airway. It's that precise, precision targeting. In other words, it leaves the rest of your body alone. No side effects to anything else. It only targets that specific molecule, we're talking about precision. But let me give you an idea. I think we must see the price in context of the entire picture. What's the price of ICU admission? What's the price of repeat hospital admission? What's the price of treating diabetes, of treating hypertension and bone density problems? What's the price that we pay in terms of loss of quality of life?
Yes.
Now, let me tell you a story. I work at the academic hospital in Pretoria. We've got a little 8-year-old girl here with us. She's got severe asthma, difficult to control, severe eczema. She hasn't slept a night in her life that she can remember.
Sure.
She's itching and scratching all the time. We put her on one of these molecules, and it's funded by the state. We managed to get it funded by the state. And I told her she must come back in a month. I want to see her in a month's time. 2 weeks later, the sister called me and said, "Come look here." And she was standing in the reception area of a clinic, the waiting area. She undressed herself down to her underclothes in front of everybody. And she was turning around and she was saying, "Look at me, look at me." And the skin
Wow.
was gone, and skin lesions were almost totally gone. And she was sleeping, and her lungs were open. So for those patients, it is really life-changing. And then it becomes difficult to say 10,000 rand a month is too much.
Absolutely, and it's sure where stories like that, it's you're making me a little bit emotional here, Professor. trying to maintain composure, but it is with quality of life. It isn't too much, and it's for someone with very severe asthma or any disease. I think where you can target specifically. I mean, it's mind blowing, and that's what I love about the show and the opportunity, Prof, to chat with amazing guests such as yourself is becoming so optimistic about the developments and also so proud of the work that's being done in South Africa. Our medical establishment is really phenomenal from the very, very top in research, through the academic hospitals down to the nursing staff. It's something that we can actually be very, very proud of, and to be able to change and affect lives. I mean, just for a little girl, they say to be proud of the fact that, look at me, that her skin is improving, her lesions, her ability to breathe. You mentioned the blue inhaler. I think I grew up going through one a month because it was, it was the 70s, and it was that era of, there's a pill for everything, right? Like, okay, you're going to walk up a hill, take a hit of the inhaler. You're going to PE, take a hit of the inhaler. You're going to the beach, and you're almost told to do this by your parents. So yeah, I'm very happy to hear as to where medicine has gone. Just as we start to wrap up, what advice would you give our listeners in terms of perhaps if they do think they have asthma, and also in terms of how we live our lives on a daily basis, just to look after our breathing function and ability?
Well, I think if you think you've got asthma, make sure whether you've got it or not,
Right.
because ignoring it will land you in trouble. Even mild asthma patients with infrequent symptoms can die from asthma. So it is a potentially deadly disease, first of all, and don't ignore it. And the second thing is, if you don't treat it correctly, especially as a child, you're going to suffer long-term consequences in terms of your lung health and lung health decline in the future. COPD, and I don't know if everybody knows what COPD is, but these are the older people with chronic obstructive airway disease, often on oxygen and things like that. That starts in childhood. It's a process that starts in childhood. So make sure your diagnosis is correct. And then number two is adhere to treatment. Understand your disease. This is very important. Education is critical. Understand your disease. Make sure that you know that you've got the right inhaler, that you've got the right plan for when there's a flare up of symptoms. And make sure that you adhere to regular doctor visits. Make sure that we measure. We don't fly asthma like a kite. We fly it like a Boeing. We fly it with precision. So make sure that we measure what's happening with your airway inflammation, what your lung function looks like. And with every visit to the doctor, go for regular visits. Make sure that we are controlled. Make sure that there aren't things that we should adjust or not adjust, and make sure that we achieve our goals of asthma management. So measure and follow up and adhere to correct treatment. And if we do all those things, it's a package deal. Take my inhalers correctly. Make sure my technique is correct. If we do this whole package deal, then it's really about a normal life. You should not become an asthmatic cripple. And
Right.
if you fall in that severe category where doing the right thing still leaves you with problems, we should explore alternatives like the biologics.
Okay, sure, phenomenal, Prof. That's a
And
great way.
smoke.
Oh, and don't smoke.
Yeah.
I think just on that, I get so just as a quick side note, I've been sober now for 19 years, and which is great. And I get asked to speak at schools quite often. And one of the things they say to me is, "Talk about vaping, please talk about vaping." And firstly, it's very difficult to talk about vaping because I always say to the schools, "With pleasure, but you get the parents to stop first," because you see all the moms sneaking their vapes into restaurants and public spaces. How, just to touch on that, how bad is vaping?
There is nothing better about vaping. Vaping is at least as bad as cigarette smoking. We still have to see what's going to happen in the future because the cigarette smoke has been with us for decades. Vaping is a new fad. We know already within this short period of time, since the inception of this habit, that there is severe pathology linked to vaping, and it severely compromises lung health, and we don't even know what it's going to look like 40 years down the line. Vaping is as addictive as cigarette smoke. The biggest problem is the addiction, and therefore, once you start it, you can't get off it, and the injury to the lung is irreversible. We're not supposed to put these things in our lung. We're supposed to put clean into our lungs.
Absolutely. I love that, Prof. Thank you. Is there a risk for secondhand smoke, like with cigarette smoking, with vaping?
Yes, of course. Definitely. I often worry about driving behind someone that's vaping because it looks like a steam engine.
Coming out of the car. It's terrible. I know it's absolutely ridiculous. In my view, in my personal opinion, vaping is just another form of drug dispensing. So the company's just found another way to sell you an addictive drug that you self-administer. That's really what it is at the end of the day. There's no gives you that high or that feeling, and you're hooked on it then forever. So definitely something not to start and to avoid. So, thank you, Prof. Really, very grateful for your time and to chat to you, Professor Andre van Niekerk. Thank you for joining us today on the show.
Pleasure, Nicholas.